Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org. So, today I want to talk about Zen and character. That's something I'm interested in. I've had an interest in for a long time. I'll talk about this again because I don't feel like I got it in this talk. But I'm just going to talk about one aspect today. The reason I want to talk about this is because I believe Zen is more than just getting quiet. It's even more than just understanding our true nature. Zen practice for me was a whole host of activities and practices and ways of looking at the world that really shaped my character in one way or another in my 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, continues to do that. And I'm interested in those ways that Zen, off the cushion and on the cushion, has an effect on our character. I think it has a potential to build character, to build a certain kind of character, this practice. And I mean that positively, not just, Calvin and Hobbes, Calvin's dad always says, when Calvin says, my toes are numb, Dad says, builds character, numb toes build character. Yeah, yesterday you said diarrhea, build character. So there's that kind of building character. And I mean, Zen builds character right too, because it's just hard. And we do things that we're not sure we can do. But I'm interested in the ways. I mean, we're a diverse group of people, and when I was a young monk, I looked around and saw how many different types of people there really are in Zen, and it affects us all a little bit differently. So I don't mean to overgeneralize, but I also realized when I'm involved with the kids program, for instance, and I am interested in with my own kids and with the Zen kids too, in helping them develop traits that will be beneficial for them in their lives. Developing a little bit more resilience, a little bit more compassion, a little bit more settledness in their life. So today, though there are different sorts of people, I think there are some things we can say about character. And today I want to talk about one practice that helped shape me and as a person, really. And that is the practice of entering. Rinzai has one of my favorite passages in this record of Rinzai talks about entering. I'm not sure if I can find it right now, but it's the question is how do you gain true insight? And the answer, Rinzai's answer, is you enter the world of, here it is, you enter the world of the secular. You enter the sacred, you enter the defiled, you enter the pure, you enter the land of the Buddhas, the Tower of Maitreya, the Dharmadhatu of Vairochana, and enter the lands everywhere which manifest, which come into being, decay, and disappear. How do you develop insight? You move. You chance. You enter all of these different worlds. Enter is one of the top three characters that Rinzai uses in this Rinzai Roku, the word enter. It's a very active practice. And so it's not just about becoming settled, it's also about moving. And in this practice, in Rinzai Zen, we emphasize that part, that kind of movement, that stepping into activity. Enter into good things, enter into bad things, enter into everything. I guess I want to preface these remarks also by saying that, you know, when you're a parent, you have kind of authoritarian control over your children. And when you're a monk, you are put in a position where others have authoritarian control over you. I mean, it's a system in which there is a lot of, you know, I had to do certain things to get up in the morning. There were certain customs that I always followed. That's just part of the deal. And I'm very aware that in lay practice, I don't get to do that with you. You know, I don't get to boss you around in a way. I don't get to set up structure for your life like I do for my kids. or like it was done for me when I was a monk. So I guess what I want to say about this entering practice right off the bat is that it's homework, if you can think of it that way. You know, I'd like to ask you to do this in your own life. Now, this practice of stopping is critical in our practice, just stopping everything and sitting still. And the realization that comes from quiet stillness is a critical part of our practice. The kind of quiet inquiry into the nature of ourselves and the world. But what I want to emphasize today is the active aspect of practice, which I think is a complement to that stillness. And also, it's an antidote to a kind of practice that can develop, a frozen practice that can develop. When we're really into kind of hiding out in the quiet, and you know, that can happen, as my friend Shinjo said of some monks in Japan when she practiced there. She felt like they were petrified monks, you know, just sitting still, but also kind of petrified to move, you know, to enter something new. Rinzai says in the Rinzai Roku, and I was taught, the follower of the way should be brisk and lively. Jigijitsu? That's when I was taught it. All right? The Jigijitsu's job should be brisk and lively. You should manifest that with your body. So not just think about it, but be brisk and lively. Get up and go. Keep moving. Rinzai says, when, you know, you should learn to walk through hell as if strolling through a pleasure garden. Walk through difficulty, my teacher used to say. You go to heaven in this practice. But sometimes heaven's closed, so you just go to hell. You just go right straight to hell. That's the spirit of this practice, is to keep moving through all sorts of manifestations, all sorts of aspects of our life, cycles of our life, and also aspects of ourselves and of others. To learn to be light on our feet, to learn to do at once practice. Brunetta, thank you so much. You know, I gotta give people that opportunity that much. Oh, could you go get this? go down there, find this, come right back up. That's part of our practice, actually, is to do that. And Wes will know, you know, sometimes in monasteries, certainly that was true in at Mount Baldy Zen Center, when you go to meet the teacher for interview for Sanzen, where you go to answer your koan, the first, whatever, 10 people, 5 people, jump up and run. That's the tradition. Run to Sanzen to get there first. And we used to knock each other off, off the path. And there were all kinds of funny things that happened. You know, people would decide, oh, I'm not going to take my shoes. I'll just run barefoot over the rocks, you know, or run up the side of the hill, you know, to create a new path. And then, of course, you get there. You know, if you win, you ring the bell, run down there, completely out of breath, you know, and you just do something, you know, at once. So there is that aspect of the practice which is hard to kind of translate into into a regular everyday lay practice. So just have to ask you to do it for homework. That kind of, to try to enter things quickly, to learn to be light on your feet, to learn not to be too precious. You know, you can. It's quite possible to feel like the result of this practice should be to walk around in a very precious and holy manner. Please don't do that. I mean, if you feel, you know, if you feel at one with the world and you feel like walking down the street, taking it all in, that's wonderful. But when somebody comes to say hello to you, enter that conversation. Break with your calm. This at-once practice, you know, the Roshi sometimes would say, you know, just at once, go do this, go change this. So at once was used a lot. And I feel like the practice of at once, the practice of entering things, is deeply a Mahayana practice. That is to say, in the Mahayana way, we ask people not to cloister themselves. You know, the Mahayana was a movement toward including lay people, including all sorts of people and into the practice. And also it introduced the idea of the bodhisattva, of us helping everybody else too. So it was a way to break open the Sangha from just the cloister of monks. But we have to be careful not to cloister ourselves as well, to sort of to think of our practice as just the kind of cloistered monastic practice that is apart from things. We have to see it as our practice also to open up to all kinds of people. That is not just what we do in life, that is also our practice. That's what I'm trying to suggest. So you will, of course, go out. You have jobs. Everybody is here, naturally relates to the world. But how do you relate to the world? How do you relate to others? How do you relate to situations in your life? Can you do it in a way that is open and brisk and lively? Some traditions, you when you leave the zendo, you turn back and bow. And in our tradition, you don't do that. You just leave. And I was taught, the idea is you just stream. You do your work here, and then you stream out into life without turning back. Just meeting it. And I think we have to, in our daily life, I'd like to encourage you to practice walking into situations that make you uncomfortable. It's part of our practice to become uncomfortable, to do things that that we don't feel that break us out of our shell a little bit. Because otherwise our practice, I think, really can become too safe, too stultified, and eventually stunted. Eventually we won't grow as much if we're not trying to enter uncomfortable situations, if we're always shying away from them. If we don't have a kind of sense of adventure in our lives. And I feel, by the way, so I'm encouraging you to do that, to go out and to go forth, because it's good for you, good for your practice. But also, I've been considering recently, it's good for others too, it's good for the whole damn world. If you are breaking perceived barriers, trying to bridge meeting people with your eyes up. I don't always do that, you know. I'm sure more than I would if I didn't do Zen practice, I notice when I'm chickening out. I can feel myself chickening out of a situation that I could meet. You know, we have to make these decisions. There are certain things that we just aren't ready to meet. And I'm not suggesting you're ready to meet absolutely every situation in your life, or even every person. But we can feel it. I can feel it when I chicken out. And I feel that that's a way that I'm letting down my practice when I do that. Like, I really do feel that that is part of my practice. So my sister came to visit recently, and she's married to a fellow with a lot of brothers, and so they've got family in Seattle, and they're quite conservative Christians, this family, this branch of the family. And then, you know, yeah, Trump supporters, and, you know, there's this kind of that wing of the family. My sister said, "So I'm really hoping you'll come over for dinner. Like, if I'm going over there for dinner, I'm really hoping you'll come with me." And she texted me that, and I just took a moment. And I knew if I was to say no, it was a chickening out. Because she's here, I have time to spend with her. So I just said, yeah, okay, deal. And I wasn't looking forward to it all that much. But I tell you, I was so glad I went. I did feel like if I said no, what kind of Zen monk am I? I did feel that. So I want you to feel a little bit of that too, a little bit of that pressure to say yes to something like that, to enter into a potentially awkward situation. And I was so glad I went. It was so interesting. It was so interesting. We build up ideas about a situation like that, you know? Another part in Rinzai, he says, enter this and enter that and enter this world and enter that world so you can see through those worlds. And one of the things that I feel is that I construct about somebody, for instance, I construct a cardboard cutout of that person or a cardboard cutout of this group, you know, of conservative Christians, for instance. And one of the advantages of meeting, of stepping through that, is that I see through that. They're not cutouts at all. You know, I went out, had a very interesting conference. There was a lot of people there. I don't know, 15, 20. And had a lot of conversations, a lot of them younger. I heard Leonard Cohen drifting through the from the other room. I thought, wow, that's different. Didn't expect that. Later, as I was leaving, the husband of the household there said, oh, my wife's a big Leonard Cohen fan, and she knew you were. So she said, why don't you play some Leonard Cohen? I thought, wow. And we got to talking about, I think some people got the memo not to ask me what I do, and some people didn't get that memo. So some, you know, we're sitting around afterwards and said, oh, so what do you do on Vashon? Kind of local, one of the local Buddhists. And so then we got to talking about that, you know, and the interfaith work that we do here. Some of them were very interested in that, and we had a real rich conversation about it. Then I left. So it was quite the experience. And I think we have to be up for those kinds of experiences. What I realized was, okay, that stretches me. It helps me put some three-dimensionality to the cardboard cutouts that I make in my life. But it also helps them. It helps the whole system, in a way, when we're able to make that step with a little bit of courage. I think this entering practice, as I just read in Rinzai, in a way orients us toward yes. In Zazen, we kind of prepare the ground for this entering, I think, by saying no to our everyday lives so that we can sit here and say yes to this present moment and learn to say yes to whatever comes in this very, you know, nice space so that we can more ably do that in our lives. Of course, we have to learn, we have to make boundaries, we have to learn to say no to things, but I think we can feel through this practice the subtle joy of entering something, of stepping over a threshold, of saying yes to something that's a little bit uncomfortable. There is a kind of a subtle joy to that, I think. Jeff Kelly came a couple of years ago and read, I'll end with this, read something from Nietzsche, which is about that yes and about that joy. I'll read it. Did you ever say yes to one joy? Oh, my friends, then you said yes to all woe as well. All things are chained and entwined together. All things are in love. All joy wants the eternity of all things, wants honey, wants dregs, wants intoxicated midnight, wants graves, wants the consolation of graveside tears, wants gilded sunsets. What does joy not want? It is thirstier, warmer, hungrier, more fearful, more secret than all woe. It wants itself. So rich is joy that it thirsts for woe, for hell, for hatred, for shame, for the lame, for the world. For it knows, oh, it knows this world. You and I, as practitioners, have to get to know the world. You have to learn to enter all aspects of the world. Light on our feet, ready to engage properly. If I were to have one word for this characteristic of Zen, I'd say it's courage. Not a big bragging courage, but a settled, straightforward courage. That's the courage of a bodhisattva. And I believe that this practice and this Zen center, this community, can help us develop that by encouraging each other, by reminding each other that this is also part of our practice, by encouraging each other not to chicken out. I think this practice helps us see things differently, not to see pain and sorrow as something terrible, but to see them, to raise them to a higher level, to see them as part of everything. And then it helps us respond differently to the things, aspects of ourselves and aspects of the world, and to enter more places with a kind of courage. This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.